This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The future of the stock market is anyone's guess. But what can the markets tell us about the future? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, October 19th. Good to have you with us. If this show had existed 35 years ago today, we're just a little bit younger, things would have been pretty dire during the numbers segment. On October 19th, 1987, stock markets crashed in what became known as Black Monday. The Dow fell more than 22.5%, which remains its biggest one-day drop in history. Of course, the Dow has more than recovered. It's up more than 1,600% since then. That's probably cold comfort, though, to anyone watching their retirement accounts this year. This week, research from Bank of America said stocks are likely to fall further into 2023. Another report from Citibank says stocks are signaling a recession. So we asked Marketplace's Justin Ho what we can learn from what the markets are telling us.
Let's start with what we know for sure. The stock market has not been happy that interest rates are rising, says Karen Cavanaugh, chief investment officer for Carolina's Wealth Management.
Higher interest rates slow down the economy. They slow down everything, including consumer spending, and so that does affect profits as well.
But this past quarter, Cavanaugh says corporate profits have been relatively decent. She says that's one reason why the stock market rallied earlier this week.
Just comes out of the blue, like, hey, well, I guess things aren't as bad as we thought. And I think the market might be a little bit oversold. And there are still some good companies out there that are earning good profits and have pricing power.
But stock market signals aren't always great predictors of what will happen to the economy.
You know, the standard joke about the stock market is the stock market has predicted 7 of the last 5 recessions.
That's Ian Dubecker, a finance professor at Northwestern University. He says we do have some clues about what'll happen. Take the index of market volatility, known as the VIX. That measures how volatile investors think the stock market will be over the next month.
And historically, what we observe is the VIX is a pretty good predictor of where that volatility is going to go. It's far from perfect, but it's better than most of our alternatives.
And right now, the VIX is above its long-term average. That's a sign that markets themselves could fall further, says Quincy Crosby with LPL Financial.
The kind of extreme up and downs that we have, not always, but typically, are emblematic of a bear market that's trying to find a bottom.
But Crosby says the fact that markets are so volatile is also a sign that they simply don't know how much worse the economy will get. For instance, a recession could happen, but how severe will it be?
We have all different kinds of recessions, right? We've got some that are fairly shallow, some that are much deeper and last a long time.
Crosby says that's why stock market signals are likely to keep changing, depending on economic data and what the Federal Reserve does with interest rates later this year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, it wasn't Black Monday, or Wednesday for that matter. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In Europe, higher prices for natural gas have helped revive demand for a fuel that had, until recently, fallen out of favor. I'm talking about coal. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the European sanctions in response, followed by Russia's decision to cut gas flows to Europe, have prompted a shift back to coal-fired power plants, despite the environmental impacts. Earlier this year, it seemed like a window of opportunity might be opening for coal producers in the U.S. But as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports, that hasn't quite panned out.
Coal is making a comeback around the world, especially in Europe, says Sonia Carley, professor at Indiana University.
European countries are desperately looking for alternatives to ensure that they can provide affordable energy.
Ahead of winter, some countries have removed caps on production at coal-fired energy plants.
And in fact, they're running several coal plants that they had previously planned to decommission or entirely retire.
Finland and France are among the nations that have brought mothballed coal-burning power plants back online. At the same time, Europe is importing more coal, driving prices higher, even though coal was supposed to be the cheaper alternative to gas. And yet, here in the U.S.,
there hasn't been as much of a move to export coal, even as it's gotten more expensive overseas.
That's Daniel Cohan, professor at Rice and author of the book Confronting Climate Gridlock. For most of the last decade, coal prices languished, Cohan says.
There have been a lot of bans on building new coal export terminals.
And without the infrastructure investments to send coal from the U.S. to Europe cheaply,
there hasn't been that much slack in U.S. markets to be able to export more of it to markets that need it.
And exports were long touted by the coal industry as a way to stay viable, says Seth Feaster, analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
Exports have never been the panacea that the coal industry has wanted it to be. And I think that's really shown here in the current conditions.
Data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration show coal exports staying flat this year compared to 2021. And while American coal production is up slightly,
what it really speaks to is that the long-term structural decline of coal is still going on,
as U.S. utilities keep on phasing coal out. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
It's been 3 weeks now since Hurricane Ian made landfall in southwest Florida. More than 130 people died in the storm and its aftermath across three states and Cuba. Thousands of homes and businesses were damaged or destroyed. The economic toll is expected to reach more than $100 billion. And that number comes from the catastrophe modeling firm Karen Clark and Company.
Hi, come on.
Karen Clark is an economist. 30 years ago, she helped transform the insurance industry by using computer models to more accurately predict losses from major disasters. It's a skill that's become more in demand as weather-related catastrophes get more common, more destructive, and more expensive. So when Ian was approaching Florida's Gulf Coast, I flew up to Boston to watch how Karen's team tracked such a storm in real time.
Hurricanes are like real estate. The three most important things are location, location, location.
For days before and after Ian made landfall, Karen's team was holed up in their office in Boston's Back Bay, tracking the storm's path. There are TVs on in every room playing the weather channel.
This morning, we've got flash flood warnings that's been effective.
In a corner of Karen's office, atmospheric scientists follow updates from the National Hurricane Center. They plug the projected track, along with wind speeds, storm surge, and rainfall, into a computer model to create what they call footprints of the storm. And then, based on a ridiculous amount of data about the properties in the storm's path, things like roof type, age, construction materials, even whether there's a garage door, the model estimates how much damage the hurricane will cause. An analysis of eight Florida hurricanes showed that the company's modeled losses were within about 4% of the actual losses eventually reported by several insurers. Karen says the estimates help insurance companies prepare for what comes next.
It's very important for insurers to get right in there as soon as they can after the event and help homeowners and commercial property owners, you know, protect their property, get them back on their feet. They know where they need to position people and where they need to send their adjusters.
A few days after the storm made landfall, their number was jaw-droppingly high, more than $100 billion in economic damage, on par with Hurricane Maria in 2017. About $63 billion of that is insured. But that was just a number on a screen. To get an even more accurate picture, Karen sent a team to Southwest Florida to assess the damage in person.
Roof, metal, windows gone.
Sarah Sinkowitz is an atmospheric scientist with Karen Clark's company, and she's walking through the wreckage of Gasparilla Mobile Estates in Placida, Florida, a mobile home park right near the coast.
Roof, definitely metal, siding, carport gone.
She's holding a clipboard, making an entry for every trailer, meticulously documenting the damage while a colleague takes detailed photographs.
What data points are you taking?
So the data points that we're looking at are the state of the roof and what the roof is made out of, so the roofing material, the state of the walls, so if there's any siding missing.
They chose this mobile home park in Placida because it was close to the eye wall of the hurricane. The eye itself is relatively calm, but the eye wall is the most intense part of the storm, with the highest wind speeds.
Any sense of what the wind speeds would have been here?
Easily, I think 110 to 120 miles per hour. You couldn't stand. You wouldn't be able to stand up. And then there's higher gusts in the heavy rain that is found within the eye wall.
The destruction is staggering. Parts of this park are flattened. Mobile homes are reduced to heaps of splintered wood, crumpled metal, and busted furniture. Some homes are still standing, but the roofs are torn off. Others, the walls are peeled back to reveal a bed or a kitchen or a dining set, more or less intact, like a dollhouse with an open side. So is this your house here?
Yeah. That was my house.
Patty Sylvia's house is missing the roof and an exterior wall. The teal front door is still standing, and you can see the lovingly painted hot pink walls inside.
Yeah. I just love how you decorated in there. It's just so colorful.
It's too bad you can't see the bathroom. The bathroom is, I don't even need to turn the lights on at night, orange.
Bright and sunny, please, Patty.
Patty and her friend Shelley are hauling a few precious belongings out of the house and into a car.
Oh, my mom and dad's wedding picture. They've both been gone for a while. They were good folks. They really were. All my life I've looked at their wedding picture on my dad's nightstand, and I've just always loved it. Nice. Yeah, I mean, the picture's ruined, but I can still see their faces.
Patty recently moved to the park to live year-round with her husband, who was battling Parkinson's disease. He died in January. Just 12 days later, a tornado swept through this same park and destroyed several buildings. Then, in September, Hurricane Ian.
8 months later, the hurricane pushes me out. But I have wonderful, wonderful friends that have taken me in for the week. And then I'm going up north where other friends are going to take me in. And then from there, I'll find something to live in. You know, I had my husband buried down here. And I hate to leave him, but there's really nothing I can do about it.
After touring the mobile home park, the team from Karen Clark and Company will work their way down the coast, assessing how different neighborhoods with different types of buildings held up to storm surge, high winds, and inland flooding. And they'll use that data to refine the model for future storms. Because one thing we know for sure is that there will be more. You can hear more about catastrophe models and the science of predicting loss on our podcast, How We Survive. Season 2 is out today. Coming up.
You know, I'm looking forward to California's very own weird and wacky way of solving problems.
And that's a Californian talking. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 99 points, 0.3%, to close at 30,423. The NASDAQ lost 91 points, 0.8%, to close at 10,680. And the S&P 500 was down 24.6% and at 36.95. We talk a lot about money on the show, of course, but rarely do we talk about who's on our money. The U.S. Mint announced today it will start shipping out quarters bearing the face of pioneering actress Anna May Wong, making her the first Asian American to appear on U.S. currency. Earnings season continues on Wall Street. Consumer behemoth Procter & Gamble beat expectations. The maker of Gillette, Old Spice, and Tide rose almost 1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.13%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Early in the pandemic, many economists and demographers predicted a big drop in the U.S. birth rate, bigger than the decline that had already been underway for years. And that seemed to be coming true initially in 2020. But then last year, the birth rate actually grew pretty significantly, enough to reverse 2 years of declines. That's according to a new paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research. And early indications are the trend is continuing this year. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
Usually when the unemployment rate goes up, birth rates go down, but not in the pandemic.
In fact, starting roughly about 9 months after the pandemic, we see what we call a baby bump.
Martha Bailey is a professor at UCLA and one of the authors of the study. She says an initial drop in the birth rate in 2020 happened too early to have been caused by the pandemic affecting people's decisions about whether to have kids.
It seems like a lot of that decline was driven by reductions in childbearing to women who weren't born in the United States.
Women from other countries who might have otherwise traveled to the U.S. to give birth, but didn't want to or couldn't because of COVID.
By the end of 2021, births for U.S. mothers were up by about 6% relative to the pre-pandemic trend.
And they were up even more among certain groups, namely college-educated women.
Women that may be more able to work from home, have more flexible work schedules, they suddenly saw what seems like a window of opportunity to start their families.
Hannes Schwandt is a professor at Northwestern who also worked on the study. In general, he says there are two things people tend to want to have before choosing to have kids, money and time.
And nowadays, time is really like a very scarce commodity, especially for like highly educated women. And a little relaxation of the time constraint made a big difference.
It's too soon to know if last year's increase in the birth rate will just end up being a blip or the start of a longer term trend. If it is just a 1 or 2 year phenomenon, Melissa Carney at the University of Maryland says it ultimately won't matter that much. But longer term birth rate trends do matter.
Economic growth depends on having a productive working age population. And so when you have a smaller working age population, income per capita can go down and our living standards can go down.
Data from California, which the researchers found closely tracks national data, show the increase in birth rates continuing into 2022. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This week, California became the first state to require discounts on insurance premiums for home and business owners who take steps to protect their properties against wildfires. The idea is to help property owners cope with rising insurance costs in wildfire-prone areas, while at the same time reducing the growing risk. 10 of the state's most destructive wildfires happened in just the last 5 years. One strategy some private landowners are using is to selectively log their land, removing smaller trees that can fuel wildfires, and selling the wood to sawmills. But that last part isn't always easy. Jane Braxton Little is a freelance journalist, and she had the story for Bay Nature magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Your article has a great title, Log Jam: The Supply Chain Problem That's Keeping California from Preventing Catastrophic Wildfire. So what is the supply chain issue?
Well, the way we're using supply chain is a little bit different from the concept that we've been familiar with in the last couple of years. The industrial chain is loggers, log truck drivers, registered professional foresters, sawmills, and the supply is coming from the forest owners. It's the diminished capacity of the industry in recent years that means that they can't always handle the supply. So it's kind of like a narrow neck funnel that slows down the flow of timber or logs from private non-industrial forest owners to the sawmills.
In your piece, you profile a couple, the Stouts, who tried to do selective logging on their property, but it doesn't go very well. Can you talk about what happened to them?
The first thing that happened was the 2020 North Complex fire, which burned around 4 million acres statewide. Some of those lands that burned included industrial timberlands, and they had to deal with their own burned trees before they could take trees from other landowners. So in the spring of 2021, they were not able to take the Stouts' timber. So the Stouts left their trees standing because they're more fire-prone when they're on the ground than when they're standing. Then the Dixie Fire happened in July of 2021, and it burned all those trees that the Stouts were planning to sell. So it was a double whammy for them.
It's just devastating to read that they were trying to prevent exactly such a thing and weren't able to.
It was heartbreaking, not just for the Stouts, but for a number of other landowners in the area. Just heartbreaking.
I should say, though, that this kind of forest management, selective logging, is controversial. Not everyone thinks it actually prevents wildfires and say it can even contribute to carbon emissions. But you, in your article, seem to see it as a solution. Why is that?
A lot of this is just really counterintuitive. And it was for me when I started reporting this. But the reporting took me to the science, and study after study documented the increase in both fire and the increase in vegetation density. And we're not talking about logging the old trees, the oldest trees. Those are the ones that we want to protect from fire. But we're talking about removing the fuels that would cause them to burn. So in order to do that logging, we need a robust timber industry.
Because, as you said, leaving the logs on the ground is not a good option.
Leaving the logs on the ground is not a good option, and leaving the smaller trees that are standing and the brush is not a good option. Now, I want to be clear that this is not necessarily the prescription for the backwoods in national forest lands. I look specifically at private lands in California.
So where do we go from here? I mean, you talk in the piece about a community effort to create a new sawmill to take some of this wood. Do you see this effort growing?
Well, I like to think that these issues are getting the attention of both the timber industry and beyond. And, you know, the timber companies that are operating these sawmills, they're involved in the communities. I think they see the need. I know they see the need, and I know that they're unhappy that they've been unable to purchase timber from local landowners. So I'm optimistic that there may be some changes at that level. But I also am quite optimistic that this crisis is going to spur entrepreneurs throughout the state, throughout the West, I would hope, to come up with inventive and creative ways to use this woody material. You know, I'm looking forward to California's very own weird and wacky way of solving problems. Mm-hmm. We'll have to wait and see.
All right. Jane Braxton Little wrote about wildfire mitigation for Bay Nature magazine. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Amy. Happy to be on your show.
This final note on the way out today, I feel like we need some Beige Book theme music. As regular listeners know, it's one of our favorite sources of economic color. The latest summary of commentary on current economic conditions by Federal Reserve District, as it's officially called, is out today. Here's a sampling directly from the report. From New York, attendance at Broadway shows has climbed, and a record 19 new shows are opening this season. From Cleveland, contacts indicated that wage increases remained necessary to retain talent amid a shallow pool of labor, which one described as more of a puddle than a pool. Kansas City. Many contacts suggested individuals are increasingly taking on multiple jobs via app-based work or have adopted side hustle micro-businesses to augment their incomes amid rising household expenses. And one more, in case you thought we were done with quiet quitting, quote, a Minnesota contact reported productivity had declined because many new hires were just getting the work done and not going above and beyond. Okay, here's your moment of economic context. Home building continues its bumpy ride. The Commerce Department said today housing starts fell 8% last month after a 12% increase in August. The overall trend since April has been down. In related news, the average interest rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, says the Mortgage Bankers Association, is 6.94%. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.